This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. When you turn your car on, does it return the favor? Visit newcadillac.gm.ca.
It's Monday, December 24th, and across Canada, children who have been naughty are bracing for a lump of coal in their stocking. Currently, I don't know what this means, but I get a nuclear isotope in my stocking. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. Canadian Bert Tatham is back home again after spending 8 months in prison in the United Arab Emirates. In April, you may remember the news story from last week. He was on his way home from Afghanistan, where he was working on an anti-poppy campaign for the Afghan Ministry of Counter-Narcotics. After stopping in Dubai, he was detained when customs officials found two poppy bulbs in his luggage and trace amounts of hashish in the lining of his jeans. Mr. Tatham says he was bringing the poppy bulbs back to use as lecture props, and that the hashish powder was the product of anti-drug work that he had been doing in Afghanistan. Nonetheless, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. While in jail, he says he was abused. Bert Tatham was released last week, along with nearly 400 other prisoners, as part of an amnesty declared for the celebration of Eid by the ruler Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. He spent the last 6 days recuperating at his parents' home near Collingwood, Ontario, and he is in Toronto this morning. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Anna Maria. Thanks.
Welcome home.
Thanks. It's nice to be home.
Now, you've been back in Canada for just a week now. How are you adjusting?
It's been an adjustment, for sure. I mean, to come back from Kandahar alone would have been an adjustment, but to bookend it with a stay in a maximum security prison, it's... along with the attendant attention from the media, it's been quite an experience.
What have you been doing since you got home?
Laying low, relaxing, spending time with my parents, my sister, brother, nieces, nephews, and my girlfriend.
You were reunited with your girlfriend. You hadn't seen her for a long time.
Yeah, almost a year, in fact, so overdue.
Now, in the first public statement you made when you got home, you apologized to your family. Why did you do that?
Well, I think, like I said at the time, if I'd been a little more careful and a little less negligent, I could have avoided the whole thing. And regardless of whether it was, you know, a clear case where I should have been put in jail for the time that I was, the worry that it caused my family and friends, I just wanted to make sure that I apologize first and foremost for that.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about what you were actually doing in Afghanistan.
Sure, yeah. I was working for the Ministry of Counter-Narcotics in a program funded by the U.S. State Department to set up a Ministry of Counter-Narcotics at the provincial level in Kandahar. I guess it should be made clear that we weren't doing any sort of enforcement or interdiction. That ministry is there only for an advisory role and a coordination role, not a enforcement or policy role. So really just setting up a team of about a dozen Afghan specialists in agriculture, public information, aid and development, and starting to get the narcotics issue on the table and all the sort of development and political and military activities going on in that part of the country.
So in the course of your work, what kinds of people would you be meeting with?
Well, for my team, they would meet with stakeholders there, be they other ministries like agriculture or irrigation, farmers a lot, the village headmen, mullahs, people of influence or opinion formers, as we'd call them, in the communities there. For myself, we acted as a liaison between the Afghan team and that ministry and the Western aid agencies, military, diplomatic, or political actors and things like that, and helped sort of push our agenda and get it on the table when decisions in those spheres are being made.
So you were working within this relatively new bureaucracy, essentially.
Yeah, we were, for all intents and purposes, building it there. There was a ministry there prior to our arrival in name, but not so much in action, so that was our mandate.
And where would you live?
We lived at a police training compound that was sort of on the outskirts of the city towards the base, where I'm sure you've seen photos of. It's a large military installation. We were not there, but we were not right in the city either.
And in the year that you were there, what did you and your team achieve?
Well, we were taking it from scratch to where it is now, and I guess, excuse me, the achievements, some of them were a little on the intangible side, but ultimately, I guess, what I saw us achieve was just to build this functioning team that would be able to do their job after I left, and my partner as well. Able to talk with confidence about the issues surrounding opium poppy cultivation, be able to convincingly talk about the alternatives to opium poppy production, building up an institutional structure that could continue to fight for consensual shifts away from opium poppy cultivation and into licit trades and farming practices.
And so on April 23rd, you were heading home from Kandahar back to Canada, and you got laid over in Dubai.
Yeah.
Take us back to that day. What happened?
Well, my last day in Kabul was rather hectic. I was running around still going to some final meetings and things. I think I went straight from the embassy, the U.S. embassy, to the airport. flew to Dubai and was going through customs. I've been through that airport, I think, about 10 times, and just eye straight ahead and through the doors. Nobody ever stops me, and for some reason, I just felt a hand on my arm and said, "Come with me." And we went into the little searching room, and they asked me if they were going to find anything, and I thought, oh, I should probably tell them about these poppy bulbs that I'm bringing home as an exhibit. So I told them that rather casually, and thought at the worst I might have to do a little bit of talking before they would accept that. And so they found those. They were quite upset, visibly upset, actually, and then began to search me more thoroughly, and that's when they started to scrape through the seams of my pants and found this fragment of hashish that had lodged itself down in there. So from there it was handcuffed and a quick procession of different buildings and fingerprints and assurances that I would be let go in a matter of hours, and assurances that I did not need to call my consulate, did not need to contact a lawyer, no problem.
What were you thinking?
I really didn't know what to think, and by this point, you know, it was getting to be 3 or 4 in the morning, and, you know, lack of sleep and adrenaline and shock. I didn't know what was going to happen to me, to be honest.
But you said you could see them getting quite agitated then when you found the pods. Like two little poppy pods? They were.
Yeah, I mean, I just picture a dried flower arrangement. It's just a little stick with a ball on the end, essentially. And if you shake it, there's a little bit of a rattle, and those are the little poppy seeds like you find on your bagel inside the bulb. So that's all.
And you explained to them that you brought them home.
Yeah. I said they were part of a UN exhibit that I'd sort of been given to bring home because I'd been asked to speak on the topic of my work, and assured them that where I come from anyway, it's not a problem to have these, especially for someone in my line of work. But I think that the one thing I remember them saying is, "Oh, you want to be a hero? Show everybody these, huh?" You know, so it's quite a bad reception.
You've called the trace amounts of hashish they found on your jeans an occupational hazard.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to remember that where I was, opium and hashish are staples, and they're ubiquitous. And there were times during my job where I was handling both, sometimes in an official capacity and other times in just a sort of get those away from here because we shouldn't be seen with these things, you know. So, I mean, I was, the one thing that sticks out in my mind is I was visiting and overseeing the eradication of some poppy in a poppy field near the town of Kandahar. It was sort of a press exercise, and we were there not coordinating it or enforcing it or anything, just to watch and to see how it was done and to see you know, what the media involvement would be and things like that. And one of a counter-narcotics official from that area of probably the top echelon prior to our arrival came over with a TV camera, I know, just off my shoulder and was handing me pieces of hashish saying, hey, look at this, here you go. And so you sort of take it out of his hand and stick it in your pocket and hope nobody saw. Things like that. Sanitizing workplaces or meeting rooms, sometimes you'd find little pieces of it around and you'd have to transport it to the garbage or just get it out of sight. So
it,
yes,
it indicates what you were up against.
Yeah, it does, yeah. I guess. And it also indicates that I did have exposure to it and its residues over the time spent there.
Now, they didn't believe any of this in terms of thinking that you were innocent. Is the legal system anything like ours that you went through?
To tell you the truth, like a lot of things in that particular emirate of the United Arab Emirates, outwardly things seem to be a certain way, but as you scratch a little deeper, they're not. And the judicial system there, on paper, sounds, you know, like a very well-oiled machine, but in my experience, it was somewhat lacking in terms of transparency and equality, and you know, I felt the brunt of it. I know it's easy to think I'm saying that just as a sore loser, but I mean, I was shocked with some of the things I saw there. So just in the judicial aspect of it alone. So,
can you give us an example?
Sure. I mean, you're in a detention area with drug smugglers, essentially, or illegal immigrants, and you could just, people would just disappear all the time. Phone calls would be made, people of influence would be contacted, and the person who was halfway through a legal case or not even beginning one would just sort of disappear overnight. And so people getting these magical pardons all the time, you know, I could go on. different aspects.
What went through your mind then when they gave you a four-year sentence?
I couldn't believe it. There were stages of this, you know, the meeting with the prosecutor where they decide whether or not to pursue the case. And it's funny, when I went to my first meeting with the prosecutor, I told them my job, the job description, my line of work, where I was coming from, and the prosecutor sort of leaned back and said, oh, okay, well, just give us a couple letters sort of substantiating that was your job and that's where you were, and we'll throw this out and that's the end of it. So of course we did all that, and it was pursued just as aggressively as before. So lots of misinformation being given out, lots of no problem. it's a refrain there. So so a bit of a shock to be taken through to the actual stage of sentencing. When the sentencing came, again hearing in Arabic what I could understand to be 4 years coming from the judge and being shuffled away without an opportunity to speak, a big shock, you know, going through the appeal process and just hearing the same thing again and again was each time just as shocking as the last. So,
you have brought with you some of your prison writings. I'm going to ask you to move over a little bit too, just for the microphone.
Sure,
but
sure.
But you've got, what did you bring? Tell us a little bit about, you've got prison,
yeah,
the journal?
Yeah, I've got my prison diary with me here. I guess the main reason why I brought it is because it has my calendar along with the, you know, the standard four sticks and a cross through it for 5 days.
You did that.
Yeah, how could you not? And also just a calendar with auspicious dates marked down just to keep track of things in my mind, you know. Court dates and other incidents of note that happened while in prison.
There was a specific incident in early August.
Yes.
What happened?
Yeah, on August 1st... there was quite an incident. A group of about 20 riot police stormed my cell block, I guess it would be called, screaming and yelling with their batons out, and sort of beat people randomly, and I was the lucky recipient of a good solid beating, clearly for no reason at all. I still to this day don't know what they were doing there. You know, pulled me out of my cell, beat me around the head and the kneecap area, made me run a gauntlet of prisoner or prison excuse me, prison guards tripping, kicking, punching me. And at the end of the gauntlet, there was a series of German shepherds sort of on short leashes barking and snarling to sort of terrorize you a little further. So yeah, a big shock.
You say it matter-of-factly, but what were you thinking at the time? That must have been terrifying.
Jeez, I don't know. At the time, I was just thinking to get to the end of the the stations of abuse and get out into the yard where everybody was sort of collecting after it.
There was no warning? There was
no warning, other than you could hear people screaming in terror and these dogs barking as this group made its way through the prison and, you know, stopping at other cell blocks to give the same treatment to others. So I guess I'm told that in the past it's happened quite often there and in other emirates as well. And, you know, I've heard stories about people trying to run but slipping in the blood on the floor and much more serious injuries occurring. So, but even in that one, there was someone had broken their back, other people broke their ribs, ankles, lots of ugly cuts and bruises and things like that.
And what happened to you?
Nothing lasting, just, you know, some bruises and a bit of a limp for a few days and a strong aversion to the sound of dogs barking, or, you know, when you hear people yelling out in the hallway, you wonder if they're coming back again. So
you testified about that incident.
Well, yes, I did. I wrote up a statement just saying exactly what happened and got that out to my consulate, the Canadian consulate. I also got it out to the Spanish and a few other of the European consulates and embassies there, just to let them know what was happening and what was happening to their subjects in this jail. And I guess that caused quite a stir, and there ended up being an investigation.
20 people, I think, were charged,
yeah,
officials.
Ultimately, the acting warden of the jail was jailed himself, excuse me, and deported, along with about 20 guards. So I wasn't the only one who protested, but I think I was one of the only Westerners that protested.
What were the conditions like in that prison?
The conditions themselves, I mean, it was a brand new prison, about a year old. So it was fairly clean, but more or less empty, you know, just a big building full of guards and prisoners and not much else, you know, no real facilities, no gyms or anything like that. A very small library with a few books, a cafeteria and a yard. That was pretty much my world, was the cell block, the cafeteria and the yard, so...
Did you talk to other prisoners?
I did. At first, when I was, for the first few months, when there were actually quite a few prisoners around, I had some friends, sort of an Italian, a couple of Italians, a few Brits, a Greek, a German. So, yeah, it was like a little United Nations.
A lot of foreigners in there.
Yeah, there were at the time. Yeah. But, of course, they left at Ramadan, when I was supposed to leave. So after that, it was a little bit more quiet.
And they kept you longer. You know, your parents made a real effort to try to get you out sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother has said that she had hoped the government would have done more to get you released. We're almost out of time, but how do you see what the Canadian government involvement?
There definitely was an involvement, and I am still trying to process through all of this. The involvement wasn't to the degree that I had hoped. There seemed to be a lot of activity in Ottawa and the Department of Foreign Affairs, and several key meetings were held. But at the embassy in the UAE, the ambassador never did contact the ruler to try and argue my case, especially after this beating, when as a result of my testimony, they actually held me off a release and let everyone else go. So it became a real human rights problem, in my opinion. And for my government to see me being held back for those reasons and to not, elevate it to the level, whatever level it needed to be elevated to get me out, was pretty discouraging. But again, I still have to get the full story from them. And it's not like they sat back and did nothing, you know.
Bert Tatham, welcome home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Bert Tatham is a Canadian who spent nearly 8 months, he spent 8 months in prison, 240 days in prison in Dubai. He spoke to us in our Toronto studio. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.